Hi, it's Charlie Hussey here with Stephen Van Zandt, the presenter of Little Stephen's Underground Garage, which is broadcast every Saturday night at 10 and Sunday at midnight. And for the next hour, we'll be talking and playing various styles of music. Stephen first told me about his experience in seeing Howlin' Wolf.
Most memorably, I saw Howlin' Wolf, fairly close to the end, but within a couple of years, I guess, before he died. And amazing. Scariest human being I've ever seen in my life. I mean, he just looked like, he was scary. And it looked like he had like a little, a little sort of toy in his hand. And I realized it was a harmonica. You know, his hand was so big. It looked like a tiny toy. So Muddy Waters, but most of my favorites, Little Walter, my favorite, and Elmore James. Never saw them, and I've never seen video of them actually. And I snatch here, a snatch there. Very rare to find them on video, for some weird reason. The South Side of Chicago stuff was my thing. I guess I got turned on to it by the Rolling Stones, I suppose. Early on. They were a little bit before. Their first couple of albums. Confessing the Blues, which they had gotten, I think, from Little Walter's version. It didn't originate with Walter, Charles Brown, somebody like that.
Willie Dixon, maybe?
No, it's an earlier. Oh. Confessing the Blues goes back to, a 40s. I want to say Charles Brown or somebody like that. Anyway, of course, Slim Harpo and Jimmy Reed. Directly from the Rolling Stones. I'd never heard of any of these guys. I'd never heard of Chuck Berry, by the way. So, never mind Jimmy Reed. I really had never heard of Chuck Berry or Bo Diddley. I was just a little bit younger, and by the 60s, these guys were all pretty much out of work. Ironically, the British invasion put all their heroes out of work. Unintended consequence. But then the John Mayo blues band and Paul Butterfield blues band in America really focused, obviously, exclusively on the blues stuff, and Eric Clapton with John Mayall, we had followed him from the Yardbirds, and suddenly the blues became extraordinarily important, and it was just an absolute necessity that every guitar player learn, the basics of the blues, whether you stayed in it or not, And we traced everything back. We traced him back to Eric Clapton talking about Robert Johnson. Eventually, the Stones would include Mississippi Fred McDowell and in their later, their mid-period records, and Robert Johnson as well.
Then you had Fleetwood Mac doing their recordings in Chess then as well.
Yeah, Peter Green followed Clapton, and then was followed by Mick Taylor. In the hierarchy of the Mayall sort of school of blues, Peter Green was amazing. Eric Clapton, pretty much, and I've talked a lot about him through the years, but he pretty much rewrote the book on blues guitar playing and influenced everybody. But my sensibility went more towards Jeff Beck. So, you know, we had... it was a wonderful time to grow up, obviously. You know, you had Clapton, Beck, then Jimmy Page, and Jimi Hendrix as the four main influential guitar players. But we also had Mike Bloomfield, very important, from Paul Butterfield Blues Band. You know, and I've been trying to get Paul Butterfield in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame now for years. We'll probably have to try and get him in as an influence rather than as a, you know, artist, I think, in the end. It's very difficult. But, extraordinarily important. The first mixed band, I think, in America that I remember with black and white guys in it, you know. It was not that typical to see that, This is like 65 or so, you know.
The drummer,
Sam Lay,
of course, still going. Jerome Arnold.
They'd come from Howlin' Wolf's group, I believe.
Yeah, Sam Lay played with.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And So they were this wonderful combination, and then Bloomfield and Elvin Bishop, you know, the two guitars, and, you know, Paul Butterfield, for me, the second best harp player I think ever, after Walter, in terms of the electric style, you know. I think I give it a Sonny Boy Williamson, I think, for the acoustic style, but they were almost mainstream for a minute. it was a wonderful moment in time there, where 65, 66. The second Butterfield album, East West, still remains one of the most extraordinary. And anybody out there who's not familiar with the Paul Butterfield Blues Band, I would highly recommend their first, I don't know what, five albums at least. All of which are different, and all of which are fantastic in different ways. But East West was quite groundbreaking, just as the Eastern influence was starting to come in, you know, with the Beatles and George Harrison's sitar and all that. And then soon with the Jefferson Airplane, and, you know, pretty much all that stuff would start to hit. 66, 67. Very early on, Bloomfield's playing those scales, those Indian scales, in the East West instrumental, which was unusual already for being a 10-minute instrumental. They actually had two 10-minute instrumentals on the second album with the Work song also. But that was a very, 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 very influential for us guitar players. You know, you had the four big rock guys, as I said, Clapton, Beck, Page, and Hendrix, and then you had the blues guys like Bloomfield, to some extent Elvin Bishop, it was name just went right out of my head from Blues Project, we should also mention, Steve Katz, oh my goodness. Right around the same time, Al Kooper had started a blues project. I can't think of his name. It's terrible. But their guitar player was quite amazing. He was the fastest guitar player, actually, at the time. And then, of course, the Peter Greens, and then later, you know, Mick Taylor. And others. I mean, you know, you had a lot of the, even Steve Marriott, you know, very impressive in those days. They didn't quite break through in America, though. We would discover them a little bit later, actually. Largely due to the Faces, once Ronnie Wood and Rod Stewart came in to replace Steve Marriott, they ironically would break in America, which is how we got them into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, both Small Faces and Faces. We insisted on that. Because the Small Faces never quite broke through. They had the one hit, Ichiku Park. But that was it. You know, they didn't really come over, I don't think, much. And then
too poppy, maybe?
No. They just were very, very English, and I think they just didn't come over enough. He'd come over with Humble Pie just a couple years later, you know, and they broke through. You know, what nobody knows is how good a guitar player Ronnie Wood actually was. Very early on, you know, you probably are familiar with the Birds stuff, which nobody in America, of course, knew about. But he's playing great guitar in 1964. You know, he was like, you know, I don't know how old, 15 or something. You know, and I mean, it's really good. You know. I would get to know Ronnie Wood as a bass player with the Jeff Beck group when Jeff Beck came over with his first group, which is one of the most greatest things I've ever seen in my life. Introduced Rod Stewart as a singer, introduced Ronnie Wood on bass, Nicky Hopkins on piano, and Mick Waller, who was a phenomenal drummer. It was only a short period. Looking back now, it would be the blueprint of what became hard rock, you know, which would last pretty much through the 70s and turn into even the hair metal stuff of the 80s, really. But the guitar players were, I mean, eventually it would become the guitar player singer relationship, pretty much equal. But for a minute, the guitar player was more important than the singer. I mean, Jeff Beck was more important than Rod Stewart. I believe Jimmy Page had Robert Plant on a salary, if I'm not mistaken. Okay. I'm not kidding. They were, you know, guitar was God, and, you know, whoever the singer was sort of a bit superfluous. That would change, you know, but that guitar player singer relationship would go right through, pretty much right through the 80s, starting which really the archetype, you could say the archetype to some extent, the Davis brothers, you know, Ray and Dave with the Kinks, or Townsend and Daltrey, or Mick and Keith, even, you know. But I think the real sort of hard rock-ish blues-based relationship thing would be the archetype, would probably be Jeff Beck and Rod Stewart, I think. Where suddenly the singer was complimenting the guitar in a funny way, you know. And then, you know, I think, you know, Led Zeppelin would pretty much copy the Jeff Beck group's template, you know, and be much more successful at it. Quite brilliant in their own way. And but yeah, well, we.
You're listening to 103.2 Dublin City FM. Charlie Hussey here with you in conversation with Stephen Van Zandt, who's the presenter of the Underground Garage that's on this station Saturday night from 10 till midnight, and also on Sunday night from midnight till 2 a.m. And of course, he's also the guitarist with the Bruce Springsteen Band. The music that we played so far, you heard Howlin' Wolf with Smokestack Lightning. Then music from Paul Butterfield Blues Band, that was born in Chicago. And there we heard Jeff Beck with Goodbye Pork Hat. More music and conversation with little Stephen after these.
On Dublin City FM, our programmes are as diverse as the leading national radio station, covering current affairs, ethnic programmes, documentaries, Dublin issues, the arts, literature, business, health, media matters, sport, nature, leisure activities, women's topics, and the very best in special interest Irish and world music. Dublin's only special interest radio station, Dublin City FM.
Certainly, all of them, you know, the four or five major guys would influence the British. The British guys were learning equally, I think, from the rockabilly guys as well as the blues guys. But yeah, there was no direct thing in America. I don't know why. I mean, it was more of a pop world in America, I suppose. You know, it wasn't, even when the Beatles broke, still pop. You know, the rock part of pop staged a coup, and rock would become the new pop. People think it was always that way. It wasn't, you know. Steve and Edie were more important than the Beatles a year before, you know. Dean Martin and Frank Sinatra, and you know. But yeah, the rockabilly thing, what was maybe it was just too primitive in its own way, and it was a moment of in that time, at 56, 57, you know, 58, maybe. Where it was just like that early primitive rock and roll that was, you know, Gene Vincent would have his hits, obviously Elvis Presley, Johnny Burnett, you know, Rock and Roll Trio would have a few hits. They'd all have a few hits. But then when the original rock and roll sort of died, it went with it. And until, you know, Brian Setzer brought it back with the Stray Cats, and Robert Gordon would bring it back to some extent. But yeah, the rockabilly guys were subtle. But you lived through Jeff Beck and Jimmy Page, you know.
The way I walk is just the way I walk. The way I talk is just the way I talk. The way I smile is just the way I smile. Touch
my baby. My radio show has been on, 10, 11 years now. For 8 or 9 of those years, I've been trying to get the TV version of it on. And maybe I'm just going to shoot the pilot myself and stop waiting around. But my concept was to not only have kids dancing to rock and roll again, which no one's seen since 66, have two bands, you know, guest bands, kids dancing, young hosts, and a house band that would play soul music. You know, you go back and you look at all the old rock shows, Ready Steady Go to Shindig, Hullabaloo, you name it. and the Kinks come on, and then Smokey Robinson comes on. You know, the Beatles come on, and then there's Marvin Gaye. I mean, every single one of those rock shows was half soul, which was, you know, you don't remember that, and which was wonderful, to say the least, because they're still influencing. You know, at that point, the British Invasion was totally influenced by soul music, and were sometimes covering those same artists a few months after they were putting out the records. I mean, the Rolling Stones covering Marvin Gaye's "Can I Get a Witness," and you know the famous story of her, of course, them covering Irma Thomas's "Time Is on My Side," and she's still pissed off about that. And Bobby Womack was pissed off about "It's All Over Now," covering Valentino's, because the Stones are putting them out literally a month or two after the original Black artist, and they were still moving up the charts. And the Stones version would kill it. In Irma Thomas's case, it was not a happy ending because Jerry Ragavoy wrote it and she got nothing from it. But in Bobby Womack's case, Sam Cooke, who was his label manager, said, "Bobby, relax. This is gonna be a happy ending for you, okay? You wrote it. And these Rolling Stones are gonna do quite well with this record." Yeah. I'm sure he made more money from, you know, being the writer of that than he would have ever made, you know. But it was a very, very closely, you know, and I think for the most part, I think mutually beneficial, you know, Irma Thomas perhaps having a legitimate, you know, maybe she would have had the hit with it, you know, maybe not, you know. But that, you know, I think occasionally... the white cover would occasionally hurt the black version. But I think mostly it was mutually beneficial, honestly. That turned the white kids on to the black artist. And that's how I know about every single black artist, you know, virtually. I mean, you eventually start listening to the originals, and you enjoy the originals. Well, you know, but when you're 12, 13, 14, you know, you tend to want to see something that reminds you of yourself, I think, or, you know, some, you know, it's a little bit easier to relate to somehow, you know. The Howlin' Wolf, you know, Howlin' Wolf would have, you know, scared 13-year-old to death, yeah? I mean, scared me, I don't know, 40 when I saw him, whatever. You know, but the Stones' Little Red Rooster, you know, you could kind of relate to, you know, where Howlin' Wolf was just, you know, a little too, you know, a little too primitive, a little too scary, you know. So it was mutually beneficial, I think, for the most part. And I mean, to this day, Little Richard's not even pissed off about Pat Boone, you know. And in those days, they were not playing the black versions. You know what I mean? Black, that was strictly on the black radio. So in white radio was not playing Little Richard at first. And he's still happy. You know, he's still like, you know, maybe saw a couple of shekels from the publishing, maybe, miraculously. But anyway, I wanted to bring that back. I wanted to bring back real soul music for real. And have a house band do it, you know, and find singers that could sing it. And they're out there, you know. And, you know, I believe that. If you build it, I think people will come, you know. You do the Face or the Voice or the American Idol stuff, and people come in that style. You know, and they'll line up thousands of them, you know. Well, if you're doing something that's in, you know, okay, I need 100 Smokey Robinsons today, then maybe they'll appear, you know. So, you know, I haven't gotten around to doing it, but that's one of my fantasies. And, to bring back soul music as well as, you know, rock and roll and as dance music, you know, which we all started off as dance bands. People don't remember that. Before there was disco and techno and house, and you know,
it's and probably, the, it's probably you know, an untapped market there for soul, because you know, I know they're all singing, but I mean, soul, you really have to be able to sing to do the soul.
Yeah,
you can get away to a certain amount of rock and roll.
Absolutely. That's very true. I mean, you know, you have to be a good singer in rock and roll, but you don't have to have a good voice. And you know, and I think, honestly, the Rolling Stones breaking through enabled a lot of good singers who did not have good voices to then make it onto the charts. I think Mick Jagger set that pace. Without Mick Jagger, I can't imagine Bob Dylan ever getting on the radio. You know, and many others. You know, you can name your British Invasion singer. But there was a wonderful moment there where the Beatles had broken through and they were the archetype pop band with nothing but great lead singers. And Andrew Oldham, the Stones manager who had worked for them, it's a true story. He ran into them on the street. He'd worked for the Beatles briefly. The Stones had put out their first single, which is one of the very, very, very few bad records. Their 100th cover of Chuck Berry called Come On. It's really not good. Yeah. And it had failed. And they may not have gotten a second chance. Andrew runs into John Lennon and Paul McCartney. They come down to the rehearsal in the basement. And they give him I Want to Be Your Man. And because the Beatles were so strong at that moment, they'd already end of 63, so they'd been dominating the charts for a year. You know, they were already, you know, extraordinarily important. I believe radio had to play it because it was a Beatles song, and that enabled the Stones to get on the charts and get people used to hearing that type of singing, which was kind of conversational, kind of bluesy, you know, odd. Mick Jagger, you know, was never a pop singer. And I think the Rolling Stones' greatest achievement is crossing over to pop for 40 years, because they never were a pop band, you know. But they made some amazing, amazing rating pop rock records. But anyway.
Music sounds better on 103.2 Dublin City FM.
It's Charlie Hussey here with you in conversation with little Stephen from his program here on Dublin City FM, The Underground Garage, and of course also Bruce Springsteen fame. The last few pieces of music you heard were, first of all, Robert Gordon, The Way I Walk, with Link Wray on the guitar, then Irma Thomas with Time Is On My Side, and finally the Rolling Stones' I Wanna Be Your Man. Back to little Stephen.
But anyway, was that sort of, I think, breakthrough vocally that allowed rock singers to even have pop hits. But yeah, when you hear I think one of the other few mistakes the Stones made was covering My Girl. I mean, you know, you compare that to, you know, David Ruffin, and you're going to hear, you know, the difference between soul singing and rock singing right there, you know. So you're right. I mean, you had to be a phenomenal singer and have a phenomenal voice to be a soul singer, and which is why the Temptations, for me, the greatest group probably ever, and made the greatest records ever of anybody. If you listen to those records, you listen to the Temptations' greatest hits, you're going to hear the greatest music ever made, in my opinion, because they got five lead singers, you know, and the greatest writers, the greatest producers ever. And that remains, I think, one of the great catalogs of all time. And, you know, you had groups in those days with multiple lead singers. Not many, you know, the Beatles, you know, Buffalo Springfield, Moby Grape, groups like the Temptations, And it just made the depth of this, of the music, you know, so extraordinary that, you know, I mean, you'd hear with Traffic, you know, Dave Mason singing a song, all of a sudden the chorus comes in, and who's singing the high part? It's Stevie Winwood, you know. That it's different than if it's a casual sideman or, you know, a casual member of the band, or if it's, you know, somebody who's a spectacular lead singer themselves coming in singing harmony. And that was the Beatles story, you know. I think it was Keith Richards who said, you know, the difference between us is the Beatles are a vocal group and we're an instrumental group, you know, which basically is the truth, you know. But yeah, that multiple lead singer thing really, you know, you couldn't contain it for long, you know. They usually only lasted a few years, because they're busting out to be their own, you know, their own singers, of course. But man, while it lasted, you know, those records are like, whoa, you know? With Lou Rawls doing this, the low part on "If You Ever In Your Mind," bringing it on home to me, you know that's what I mean. You hear that low voice and it's Lou Rawls. Well, that's better than if it's not Lou Rawls, isn't it? Of course, yeah. Sam, you're talking about the Soul Stirrers, I think. Yeah, which was again, whatever. Those gospel groups were all lead singers. Exactly. That's a very good point. I mean, that's where it all comes from. And those guys had no differentiation, I don't think, between who was lead singer and who wasn't. You know, I mean, they just were all that good, just singing in different registers. And that, you know, and that would extend to doo-wop to some extent. I think the lead singer had more to do with their personality almost than their voice. In a who was the most outgoing, or, you know what I mean, who was the...
Or maybe who started the group first.
Yeah, you know what I mean? You know, who had the car, maybe.
Yeah.
You know, who owned the microphone, you know? Because, I mean, you know, you listen back to those records, and again, with doo-wop, it's very obvious that, you know, the quality of the background vocals is a bit, you know, it's extraordinary. Even Dion, you know, as great as Dion is, you know, Dion and Belmont, you listen to those early records and they're just great, you know, and when they're all singing together, you know, you can't say, oh, that's obviously the lead singer there and the other guys are kind of with them. No, you know, they're all equally great, you know. You would like to think that's not something strictly from the past, it'll never happen again, but everybody's so greedy and you name it now, right? It's it's hard to picture it ever happening again where you have more than one talented person in a group, you know, which is why there's no good groups, you know, then very few, and why they don't last very long. Well, even in the old days, they didn't last too long, but you at least get a couple of great albums out of it. The Temptations, even with David Ruffin, has got to be at least 12 or so. Not that he sang lead on every one of them, but as when he was in the group, my Temptations' greatest hits, I think, is 22 songs, and at least half of them are with him in the group. You know, and they would continue making great records even in the psychedelic era and all that. You know, with Norman Whitfield producing, but you know, they got a good 10 amazing singles before they, you know, moved on. And can you imagine, that's all you need these days. You do 10 amazing singles, you got yourself a career, baby. You know.
Yes, you certainly would have a great career with 10 hit singles. That was, of course, Little Stephen, whose Underground Garage is on every Saturday night between 10 and midnight, and repeated again on the Sunday night between midnight and 2 a.m. And if you like blues, don't forget you can catch myself, Charlie Hussey, here on the Blues Train every Sunday night between 10 and 12 midnight. The last piece of music you heard was The Temptations and Just My Imagination, and we're going to leave you with Soul Stirrers and Jesus Gave Me Water.
Jesus gave me water. I wanna let his praises swell. Jesus gave me water. Jesus gave me water. Jesus gave me water. And it was not in well.